Let me interrupt your conversation. There will be an opportunity to resume it in a little while. But first, let me just bid you welcome, or welcome back, as the case may be, to the community of St. Stephen's College, which has been occupying this corner of the University of Alberta campus, if you didn't know that, since before there was a University of Alberta, and has, over the last 100-odd years, become more and more intentionally ecumenical and interfaith in its identity. And so it's been a great delight for us to have been friends with David for the last little while. He's been a member of College Senate for several years. And although it's never pleasant for a community, even a community like St. Stephen's, to say farewell, it's always been a pleasure for us to be invited into conversations where we can gather the community for whatever purpose. And so this evening, let me just welcome you. David's going to share some reflections with us. There's going to be an opportunity for some conversation. And there's food and drink and lots of time at the end of all of that to take our leave of David and Shelley in whatever way we need to over the next little while. So, without further ado, welcome to St. Stephen's. Take it away, David.
I was exaggerating, by the way, saying little. Short while, you know. That's a relative term, I guess. It's a pleasure to be here at the college. As Earl's mentioned, I've been on the Academic Senate. When I first came on, I wondered what I was doing there. But it was a great experience for me. And actually, it was here at the college that I began. I've been doing a lot of writing on other things, but then I became interested in dialogue because of discussions that happened here, or dialogue, at least theoretically, and mainly in discussion about whether or not you could have dialogue with a boat. And I felt you couldn't. And that's what that led me to thinking about what dialogue meant. And I still think you can't have dialogue with a boat. But I do think dialogue is important. And I think dialogue is, and I think what we mean by dialogue, and especially where we want dialogue to end and what its goals are, is extremely important. So I don't know if people looked at the ad terribly carefully. Did anybody see anything interesting in the name of this talk for tonight?
American spelling.
I don't think it is. I don't think it is, actually. You may have noticed that the UE on the dialogue was omitted. And that was intentionally done so because my title was Dialogue with a Difference, and difference is the important thing that I'm thinking about tonight, about what dialogue's about and how we can think about it in a different way than normally we do, so which changes the goals. And actually, it was a discussion that Julian organized here that really got me thinking about it in a very systematic way, because I had a bit of an altercation with one of the other panelists where he felt very strongly that dialogue was about transformation, and I wondered whether that was true or not. So this is my response. He's not here, but maybe that makes it better. I don't know. So that being said, let me think a little bit about dialogue. And so I want to think a bit, and of course, dialogue has a long history, going back well before the beginning of major interfaith discussions, which probably can have their date being 1893 with the World Parliament of Religions. That was sort of the beginning of interfaith discussion, but it really goes back much further than that. The first dialogue that I found evidence of, at least within the Jewish, non-Jewish world, is Justin Martyr's famous dialogue with Trypho, which of course purports to be a dialogue or a conversation between Justin and a Jew named Trypho, nice Greek name anyway, demonstrating the superiority of Christianity over Judaism. And that was the purpose of its being written. While the dialogue may or may not describe an actual conversation, I don't think it really does, between Jew and Christian, it did serve to a great extent to be a model for medieval dialogues between Jews and Christians, especially in how they're presented, in that the goal, like that of Justin, was to present a one-sided proof of the truth of Christianity. Now, of course, Christians don't have a monopoly on that. Yehuda Halevi, in his Kuzari, does exactly the same thing, writing a book in this case rather than probably very much like Justin in this case, writing a book about a dialogue between Jew, Muslim, Christian, and a philosopher. And proving, of course, that Judaism is the correct answer, and of course, all the Khazaris are totally convinced, and instantly convert to Judaism, which may or may not be totally true. And of course, these events were great showpieces for the church in its attempt to convert Jews of Europe. Now, interestingly, within the Muslim world, there is an interesting exception to this adversarial triumphalist approach, and this is from the 10th century. And it was written, the description, interestingly, was by a contemporaneous Egyptian Muslim historian, Ibn al-Humadi, who describes very disparagingly an event he attended in Baghdad. So this is what, and he was very upset about it, and he wrote a letter criticizing what he saw. And this is what he saw, and I quote, "One of the Spanish theologians, Abu Omar Abi Ahmed Ibn Muhammad Ibn Sadi," so actually he was the one who visited Baghdad, and he was asked if he had the opportunity of attending one of the assemblies of Kalam, which is a form of Islamic philosophy. "Yes," he answered, "I attended twice, but I refused to go there for a third time, for this simple reason, which of course you'll appreciate. At the first meeting, there were present not only people of various Islamic sects, but also unbelievers, Zoroastrians, materialists, atheists, Jews, and Christians. In short, unbelievers of all kind. Each group had its own leader, whose task it was to defend its views. And every time one of the leaders entered the room, his followers rose to their feet and remained standing until he took his seat." Quite appropriate, actually. In the meanwhile, the hall had become overcrowded with people. And one of the unbelievers rose and said to the assembly, "We are meeting here for discussion. Its conditions are known to all. You Muslims are not allowed to argue from your books and the prophetic tradition, since we deny both, and we likewise are not allowed to argue from our books, since you deny those. Everybody, therefore, has to limit himself to rational arguments." The whole assembly applauded these words. They proposed that I should attend another meeting, but I found the same calamity there. Now, while a modern pluralistic multi-faith dialogue would not, and to my mind, should not limit the use of any scripture in describing a particular faith, nor should it be a debate where one side or another attempts to score points in the establishment of truth, at least in my mind, this ancient dialogue is unique in that all religions, well, a large group of religions, and indeed non-religious people, were permitted to present themselves on an equal footing. That certainly didn't happen in 1893, and doesn't even always happen today. There is no indication in this text that the majority religion, Islam, was exerting its power in any way, as was done in the Christian-Jewish dialogues of the Middle Ages. And they weren't forcing or trying to encourage, at least explicitly, conversion, although I suspect it was a hope. Like many modern dialogues, however, the pluralistic freedom expressed in this narrative is tempered by the idea that an essential, single, universal truth can be established through discussion and debate. That actually is my primary problem with the whole process, but still I find it fascinating as an open debate that certainly didn't happen again till the 20th century. Narratives of conformity and universality still form an important and implicit and often explicit element of Western culture. Though, for example, in theory, Americans and Canadians value individuality, there is also constant pressure from the media and other outlets to speak and be more American or Canadian. This is, in extreme, leads to bigotry and xenophobia against perceived minorities. And within the interfaith movement, this pressure for conformity is also exemplified by a desire by many to overemphasize the similarities rather than differences between faith groups. So, and that's really what I want to focus on today, is that challenge. While the discovery of and stress on similarities does create a degree of comfort, which can enable different communities to work in concert with one another, when it becomes the focus or the end of interfaith discussion, it not only masks unique aspects of world religious traditions, but in truth creates an artificial unity where we see the other only through ourselves. And that's the real challenge that I think we face. Indeed, our religious traditions are diverse, with vastly different histories and understandings of the divine, or even if there is a divine, views of spirituality and diverse views of spirituality and foci. Indeed, religions like Judaism, Christian, Islam, which share a common thread of tradition and text, and claim relatively similar monotheistic views of the divine, are indeed very different from one another. even though we stem from very similar roots. So think, for example, of the idea of the Trinity. That would be considered antithetical to monotheistic understandings of both Judaism and Islam. It really wouldn't be considered as monotheism. So there, that's even within systems that claim monotheism, we look at the divine in very, very different ways. And even to, and we often simplify how we look at the other or misunderstand how we look at the other in our degree of horror. Even in cases where there are commonalities between various religious traditions, one tradition may value its golden rule, while another tradition might see that same rule as relatively unimportant. Indeed, the seemingly shared values might mean very different things when placed into the context within its own religious tradition. This, therefore, in thinking about this, the search for commonality really should only be a beginning of dialogue, and maybe not even of dialogue, but rather in community and conversation. The comfort it creates should be built on explicit goal that's merely there to provide a foundation of trust, which will allow for people to engage in the far more difficult and dangerous process of appreciating and understanding differences among communities and traditions. That is, to find real interfaith communication and understanding. We understand each other when we learn about each other and see who we want to be seen. We see each other as we want to be seen, not as you want to see us. If commonality is the desired conclusion rather than the start, then I don't think dialogue has ever occurred, at least not true dialogue. Dialogue, or even the simplest communication among people of faith and of no faith, is essential to create bridges of understanding and acceptance. It is the keystone which enables us to learn about other traditions and educate others about our own. Every moment when we meet another human being is an opportunity for dialogue, whether we call it one or not. Yet dialogue is easier as a dream or ideal than as an actualization. Unlike summit meetings, there's no outside force, and indeed there can't be an outside force that tries to impose a settlement. Instead, it has to be a discussion among people who see each other as equal with a like-minded commitment to learn and build understanding. And I've cut out a section that because I want to keep this relatively short, but I also want us to remind ourselves that every time people talk together is a form or a chance for dialogue. It doesn't have to be a great set event where you have people talking heads sitting up front. Probably discussions in the pews are far more important about what really is getting to know each other. That's the real dialogue. The equality and respect expressed so fully in the text describing the Kalam Academy was to a degree missing at the World Parliament of Religions, because there, Christianity was by far the dominant force. Over 70% of the papers were Christian, and even more were from Christian presenters, so that there was no sense of equality, and when every day began with the Lord's Prayer and the singing of Christian hymns, you set up a stage immediately for real equality and open understanding, especially also since many of the papers were given by missionaries talking about the difficulties of converting peoples from these indigenous religions. So that doesn't set up really a sense of openness or equality, yet of course it is a model for beginning of discussion. It was dramatic and revolutionary for its time, so it's really unfair for me to judge it based on the standards of the 21st century. It was revolutionary and a beginning, but it can't be seen as an end. Some have suggested that true dialogue requires at times a radical transformation in the theologies of the participants, insofar as it necessitates an acceptance and legitimacy and truth of the other. While I think this is great, I actually don't think it's a requirement of dialogue. I think dialogue should not be predicated on agreement or acceptance. Rather, it should only be predicated on the willingness to listen and learn about the other. I don't have to agree with you. I don't have to accept your ideas as the truth. But I have to listen and hear what you have to say and hear how you want the world to be seen rather than how I want the world to be seen. So it really should be predicated on a willingness of all participants to listen and learn about the other without necessarily requiring acceptance. Dialogue provides an opportunity for sharing and for growth by all its participants. Unlike an argument or debate, however, its goal should not be to change belief, and here I disagree with Bruce, or convince participants of the strength of one point of view and the weakness of the other. I think that then becomes dangerous. Rather, as Leonard Swindler suggests, dialogue is a two-way communication between persons who hold significantly different views on a subject with the purpose of learning more truth about the subject from the other. And while I would question the word truth, since I think that's a very dangerous idea, it is through this mode of communication that we begin to see the other as they would be seen and understood, thus dispelling both ignorance and preconceived notions. Indeed, Rabbi Tony Bakefield suggests that dialogue is most successful when it acknowledges the worth of independent faiths, permitting their exponents to be themselves. Hietemann rightly suggests that differing religions are like apples and oranges, unique and unrepeatable. And I think that's a really great model for us to think about. We often want to think about religions as apples, and therefore we can compare them and we can find the true essence of appleness. But then we're missing, to my mind, the point. And now I'm going to mispronounce this guy's name, but that's okay. S. Wesley Ariaga describes dialogue as providing an opportunity to build a community of conversation where people learn to see differences among themselves not as threatening, but as natural and normal. He suggests that dialogue has the potential to create relationships necessary to solve conflict, not necessarily in the short term, but rather in the long. He reinforces the idea that true dialogue cannot ignore or paper over differences or even those areas that lead to conflict. Rather, it demands that we examine and discuss those issues. And that's a really important point I'm going to come back to. It is not only when we dispel misconceptions, ignorance, and stereotypes and gain instead the, it is rather only when we dispel misconceptions, ignorance, and stereotypes and gain instead an informed perspective of other people's experiences, embracing difference and diversity, this is a quote, that we can create a vibrant community of peoples. So I want to think about that a bit, because dialogue, as we set it up often in our interfaith communities, is really almost a dangerous exercise, because we look often for this idea of apple and apples, so we try to find commonalities so that we really understand what religion is. So we say, the golden rule is a fact that every religion has. That's not really true, so it's not a fact, it's a belief, but we're trying instead to see people as ourselves rather to see people as we really want to be seen. And this is a whole other talk, but I've talked elsewhere about the idea that the golden rule is, and this whole model is where we take something that we see as very important, and then we look for it with everybody else, because if it's important to us and is our essence of religion, then it must be the essence of religion for everybody. So the process of dialogue and discussion is rather a process of finding ourselves in the other rather than finding the other in the other. So true communication and the creation of relationships are therefore also impeded because of the failure in most of our organized dialogues to confront critical and difficult issues that separate people of faith. Instead of examining the hard issues that separate, and I put here a list of religions, I'm not going to even say it because the risk I could go on forever with the list. Instead of examining the hard issues that separate people of faith, we choose topics that everyone can speak to in generalities, demonstrating how wonderful and benevolent their traditions are, while ignoring the elephant, that is to say, the all-too-real conflicts that might create tension or disrupt the feelings of fellowship. So we chose peace, the environment, fellowship. Think of all these wonderful topics that we always choose for dialogues, where we all can say wonderful things about them. Yes, we're all for peace. Isn't that great? Yes, we all believe in stewardship of the earth. Yes, interesting, we often choose these sort of Christian code words for it. You know, stewardship isn't a term I've ever seen in a Jewish text, but it becomes the goal of, it forms the context of some of these discussions. Or we all love the golden rule. Isn't that great? And we find these topics that make us all feel so good because we all agree, isn't it wonderful? We're all really the same. So we ignore anything that really says anything about our religious traditions, and instead everybody leaves feeling good, and then our dialogue is a success. This failure of our formal dialogues is that we shy away from complex issues. And it's often demonstrated by the questions that follow presentations. David and I have addressed numerous, and actually, I think Julian's done a few as well, numerous Ahmadiyya dialogue of these kind of presentation dialogues, and they choose these nice, wonderful topics. And then, if you listen to the questions afterwards, you realize that at least the non-Ahmadiyyas that come, which is generally a small number, are not fooled by the brotherhood and fellowship that we've all established up front, and instead they ask the really difficult questions. But of course the Ahmadiyyas are clever. They make sure that people write down their questions so that none of the really hard ones get asked. That's another strategy. That's another strategy, and then not only that, we at Interfaith Center Events, we've done the same thing too. And it really is missing the point. We want to make control of the message and make sure everybody feels good, so we don't allow any questions which might make someone not feel good. But maybe we're missing the point. Maybe not feeling good is part of the process as well. I remember I was at a dialogue that was organized in my mother's synagogue, and there they were discussing issues of parenting. And this was another failure of dialogue. There people ended up not feeling good, and the reason they ended up not feeling good was that the Christians in the audience were horrified that a more traditional Christian talked about parenting ideas that they couldn't agree with. She didn't believe in television. She didn't believe in, she believed her kids should be respectful. Strange ideas. And the more liberal Christian attendees that were horrified because they didn't represent the ideas of their particular understanding of Christianity. So they thought, she can't be, she's not really Christian. You know, they were missing the point. But also suggests us that maybe sometimes intrafaith discussions are even more difficult than interfaith discussions. That's certainly true in Judaism. And interestingly, even when really difficult issues are brought up for interfaith discussion and dialogue, they're often glossed over as well. Now, I'm going to apologize to Denise for talking about a conference that she organized, but I think she remembers it probably as well as I do. There was a conference here at the University of Alberta recently where we discussed our religion's approaches towards homosexuality. And it was really great. Everybody, and there was, I have it down, Jews, Buddhists, Muslims, Christians, one from the United Church and one from Pentecostal, we all agreed. We love the homosexual. Isn't it great? You know, and probably for most of us, we're being honest. But I don't know. You know, there was certainly, I think some of the people on that panel, at least one of them, probably his religious understanding probably didn't preach this wonderful, warm, welcoming feeling, but he didn't want to say it. And then, of course, during the question period, all of the baggage came up of the people who said, well, that's not my experience in your religious traditions. Why aren't you being honest and telling me really what happens? And I think that's where the truth and the difficult stuff really came out, which should have maybe been there in the presenter. I don't think that necessarily the presenter should have felt, oh, we have to be warm and huggy and kumbaya-ish. Maybe they should have been honest, and then we could have made some progress in understanding where our religious traditions come from. But we're afraid to do that because we don't want to look like we're bigots, even if we are one. That was a bit judgmental. I apologize. But not too much.
Oh, yeah.
You know, since I'm leaving Edmonton, I can see what. Not quite. Although, it's the fear of presenting and making ourselves look warm and fuzzy is really a big impediment to most work that we do in engaging and trying to create bridges of understanding and real and confront the difficult issues of our time. Not so long ago, even the Interfaith Center confronted an issue which was very difficult for one of the communities and found it impossible, at least initially, to say anything because that community felt, or someone from the community felt, well, I don't want to present my community in a bad light, or how it might be perceived in a bad light, even though we actually were saying the opposite. So it's being afraid to be honest about our traditions and confront ourselves and our own traditions is a real challenge as well. We have to be willing to confront ourselves as well as the other and understand where we really are coming from and be honest about it. Otherwise, we're just wasting our time anyway, to my mind anyway. Okay, so unfortunately, even also, let me skip that. Okay, good. If I skip it, then there'll be more time for questions, which is good. And then you can ask the difficult questions that I haven't faced. As has been discussed, a focus on differences between traditions has the potential both to be dangerous and divisive. Indeed, people entrenched in their own belief systems may be horrified by beliefs and traditions far different from their own. So, for example, strict monotheists may be shocked on seeing or hearing about multiple images of God found in a Hindu temple. And I actually was horrified. I was reading today, there's a new book that came out on conservative Judaism called Faith and Practice or something like that. Long book with all about the practices that are enshrined in our movement, although we have total freedom to disagree, so we don't really believe in creeds. But in this book, they said, oh, Jews are not allowed to go into Hindu or Buddhist temples because these are places of idolatry. Well, and I understand that. I was sort of horrified that it came from the group that I belong to because it's not a view that I espouse, but I understand it, and maybe being honest that my religious tradition does have that is something important to say. So if we're having a dialogue about images, my saying that at least is being honest, so you understand where I come from, if that was where I was in my present. And realizing that is an important thing, that I think that we have to realize that we're not always going to be easy or find it comfortable to be talking to other people. And that discomfort is essential. If we don't have that discomfort, we can't ever think about where we are, but we can't also understand the other, because we all feel good and that's great. You know. So, and it becomes a challenge, actually, even within other religions as they've been construed in modern times. This is an aside that's not in my prepared text. But in thinking about the creation of Buddhism and Hinduism, which were creations of the Christian West in the 19th century, these religions were construed in ways that, I'm not saying that the various religious practices that make up these religions didn't exist before then. What I'm saying is the overarching structure, calling all of these practices Buddhism or all of these practices Hinduism, was a colonialist exercise of power. There's some really interesting books on that that have been done in the last few years. But one of the things that it did was it makes it so Hindus are very embarrassed about their particulars and the multiplicities of what Hinduism is, Buddhists the same, so that Hinduism struggles to say, create this universal idea that we actually don't believe in all these lots of gods, we actually believe in a divine power behind all of them. But if you're looking at that, you're not really understanding the amazing complexity that's Hinduism. And the same thing with Buddhism. Buddhism is an amazingly complex structure that has so many differences that we all put into this one pile the one thing that we call Buddhism. And then of course Western Buddhists love to say, well, Buddhism isn't a religion, it's a philosophy. But I've heard Eastern Buddhists say that's not really true. But it makes it much more comfortable to fit in a Western construct if we don't actually believe in lots and lots of gods, but we believe in whatever. So there people are trying to fit in to a nice structure that will make them feel comfortable and happy sitting here in the West. That's a very important danger that we face. We all want to fit into the structure. It's actually happened even here in the university, where we want, when we look at what it means to be a chaplain, we take the model of the West, which Jews and Christians primarily have adopted, and we say that kind of education and that kind of responsibility are what all chaplains should be doing. And it's a challenge then for us, and we've been working hard on it. Richard and Denise and I know about this all too well. We've been working hard and struggling with what it means to be a chaplain at the university with religions that don't have seminaries, that don't have MAs in religious studies or whatever else we like to require for chaplains, or we used to require. So it makes it really challenging to think about how we can move away from our Western assumptions to looking at and appreciating diversity, and that people come from very different places than we do, and what people mean as clergy is very different than what we often mean as clergy. Dialogue is not predicated on transformation of one's tradition, I didn't finish that thought, so let me finish that. So we come to these things and we see traditions that are very different from our own, and the temptation is to be horrified. Yet the future of interfaith understanding and positive relationships require that we approach other faiths, and indeed our own faith, with an openness not to change our belief system, but rather with a desire to learn about other world faith expressions without judgment. And that's what a very important point for me is, to learn that, yes, this is my belief system, that I am a monotheist, but that doesn't mean that Denise has to be a monotheist. I'm sure she is, but, well, I shouldn't make any assumptions. But it's not predicated, I should look at Denise without judgment in whatever she believes, and I'd be interested in learning about that rather than trying to fit her into my system and be horrified when she doesn't fit into my system. Dialogue in this sense is not predicated on transformation of one's tradition or theology. Indeed, there is no call for me for one to abandon oneself to be part of the process. Rather, the opposite is true. For me, a dialogue is most successful when each participant openly and honestly shares who he or she is and what he or she believes, without worrying about judgment. So feeling the freedom to express and be true to themselves in the process. I think that's maybe the biggest challenge we face in our dialogues, is creating that trust so that we can be ourselves. Yet I think there are some levels of transformation that implicitly occur for me, or and are appropriate for me to implicitly occur. The first level is a transformation in knowledge of self. Self-revelation is built on introspection and self-acceptance, and I think that those are necessary prerequisites for speaking with integrity and authenticity. So being part of a dialogue requires looking at oneself and finding out where one really is, and then speaking the truth from one's heart about who he or she is. The second level is also introspective in that it demands the confrontation with one's prejudice, fear, and hatred rather than those of the other participants. I engage in dialogue not to make you not hate me, but to allow me to understand you and to remove my hate from you. Your process is to be for you too. You know, the process you go in has to be yours. I can only change myself. I don't want to change anybody else, except in the level of understanding. In both these levels, self-understanding along with the greater understanding of the other is a desired transformative end. And I guess, in a sense, you would say that the change is mutual, in that I would hope that Andrew comes to the process also with the true desire to learn about me and to remove his stereotypes and hatred of me and prejudices, built instead on a communication of understanding of who I am and a communication of who he is. So there is a mutuality there, but it's a very different mutuality than we often expect from dialogue, where we engage in it so that we can grow together and gain a new understanding of God or a new understanding of this, or we all share each other how wonderful we are, and then we don't learn anything. An added complexity, by the way, to interfaith understanding is the idiosyncratic nature of interfaith presentations. And I think this is one that we don't often think about, which is created by the ongoing development of religious traditions and the complexity of identity construction. Religion, like any other aspect of human culture, is constantly changing and developing as it responds to the realities faced by adherents. So therefore, each person also, perforce, can only bring his or her unique understanding of their tradition, an understanding which is shaped by their own personal history and worldview. So that my understanding of Judaism is not the same as Netta's or Francis's or Shelley's or whomever. Each of us is unique, and we bring all the pieces of our personality that shape the Judaism that we present. Even if we're presenting a creed, I might say, this is the essence of the creed, whereas Julian might think, well, no, this is the essence of the creed, and they're both in there, but we would stress things in different ways. Even how we say it would show where we come from, and we can't help but do it, and it's not a bad thing, it's a good thing, because each of us is unique, and we can learn, but what we're learning is about one view rather than the whole view. That's maybe important to think about. One presenter might understand the different roles of Judaism as sexist, while another might stress the differing spirituality of one gender as compared to the other. Indeed, such explanations are not static, but develop over time as human culture changes and evolves. So, for example, 200 years ago, if you were in an Orthodox synagogue, there would be no rituals connected with a girl becoming 13. But if you went to the Beth Israel synagogue in 2 weeks from now on Sunday night, you would find a bat mitzvah of the rabbi's daughter. So there's certainly a transformation there. And but that would be a very different bat mitzvah ceremony as the one you found in Beth Shalom a month ago. So so the complexity is it's a religion is an evolving thing. It's not a dinosaur. That's interestingly a challenge that Judaism often faces, that people come and say, well, why don't you do sacrifices, you know? Or how do you have absolution if you don't have sacrifices? Or, you know, what do you do now that you don't have a temple? You know, that was a long time ago. These complexities render all interfaith presentations, to my mind, and dialogues as idiosyncratic, local, and contingent. Yet even so, they remain the essence of interreligious understanding. As we listen and participate in dialogue, it enables us to begin to understand something of the other as we allow them also to understand something of ourselves. At the best, dialogue helps us to understand the uniqueness of each human being and the diversity of expression even within a single faith group or culture. Rather than creating grand narratives which artificially attempt to bring everyone together or even bring everybody in a little group together or impose the shared essential message of all religion, real peace, coexistence, and understanding will only come when we value the other without any interest in making or seeing them like ourselves. Now, I want to deal with one other very important aspect of dialogue, and I'm going to skip quite a lot because I don't want to actually keep you for a huge amount of time. And that is the danger of dialogue which is built on the danger of how our minds function. So there is a more fundamental challenge to successful dialogue in addition to all those that I've addressed previously. And that is the mode of how the human mind works through the imposition of systems. We take in stimuli, whatever the source, be it tactile, verbal, or visual, and we use the internal systems to fit into a structure of understanding. So I see netta, that means light is bounced off netta, comes into my eyes, and then goes and then is interpreted by the various cells in the back of my eyes, goes into my brain, and I interpret that in general terms as woman, and in more particular terms as netta. But so I'm fitting her into my model, because and when I see other people who look like that, or some configuration of that I see the same thing. But it's only a model that our mind creates that allows us to understand that this is indeed woman, or that's purple, or that's white or blue. Our mind is construing, and I don't know, does Denise's purple, I hope she agrees with me that that's purple, does that purple look the same really to Larry? I have no idea. Does it even matter? I don't know. But, you know, it's, think about color blindness. It's, you know, that's where the models don't work and the stimuli don't create the same definition. It goes into the whole idea of semiotics, that we see here chair, but in another culture, they could see table. We base this, and we see that based on our own definitions and our own models. And I deal with this much more significantly in other writings, so I'm not going to go into it more than that today. But philosopher and theologian Peter Rollins suggests we never see the world as it really is, but always place meaning onto it. This level of interpretation creates a barrier between the other and ourselves, because when we hear things, we also are placing a level interpretation on that which we hear. And we're trying to fit it into the models that fit within our structures. So we hear Buddhism and we try to fit it into the narrative of religion because it works nicely. Or we hear someone talking about something and we say, that means this. So we take our own model and we take that which we hear and we impose ourselves upon it. This level of interpretation creates a barrier between the other and ourselves. Buber, therefore, suggests in his discussion of dialogue, a contentless dialogue as the true meeting place of the I and the you. Indeed, Buber identifies the true moment of dialogue as a place where the relation, this is a quote, where the relation to the you is unmediated. Nothing conceptual intervenes between the I and the you. There's no level of mediation or judgment or interpretation. Rather, just that infinitesimal second of the meeting between me and you. without content, he implies, we allow for the true encounter of the other without imposition of self or of ego. These authentic moments of dialogue are infinitesimally short, he contends, because we, perhaps perforce, almost immediately begin to add content, and therefore we immediately to objectify the other and turn the other into an it. Buber points here to the challenge in all communication. As we listen, we interpret and begin to see the other in our own terms rather than his or her own terms. This challenge is especially germane in interfaith dialogue where unfamiliar traditions are presented, as it is normal human reaction to attempt to normalize the unfamiliar other by placing it within an accepted model or narrative. Buber points out that humanity generally sees the world and all that is in it in a utilitarian way. Everything, including other people, are examined within this context of how it or she can be useful. In this way, we transform and see them as objects, or in Buber's term, as its, rather than as yous. I guess he probably said it in German, so not quite it, but you got the meaning. Something we can enter into, rather than a you, which is something that we can enter a relationship with. Buber claims that you can't really be in a relationship with an it. You can only be in a true relationship, with a you. Dialogue as an I and you process, then, is primarily about the creation of relationship and not about enhancing communication and understanding. There's almost a mystical sense that it is the realization of the underlying connectivity of all being that is the basis of Buber's concept of dialogue. It's almost, again, that search for an essential message, and in this case, the essential humanity, which may be even dangerous in its own place, but I'll leave that to you to determine. True dialogue, in this sense, reveals a connectivity and relationship not only between one human and another and between one human and the world, but for Buber, more fundamentally, between one human being and the divine. While Buber is certainly right in identifying this challenge to ongoing content-rich dialogue, is it sufficient to curtail all but the briefest encounters? Should we have our interfaith dialogues, Len, Julie, and me, smile at each other, that's it. And everybody, hopefully, in the crowd smiles at us, too. That would be our dialogue. I don't know that would be hugely useful, except maybe to realize that we all smile. It could rather be suggested that Buber's silent, contentless dialogue is only the necessary first step to true dialogue, as the participants first realize the I-thou relationship, and then they move slowly and carefully from there. If we stop here, we are trapped in our own perceptions because we immediately begin to the unconscious process of interpretation and objectification as we place that person within the narrative of existing taxonomies. So for even with Buber's dialogue, if we don't go on from there, we're still trapped in this process of objectification and we can't ever break from it. And because there isn't really even a chance to break from it because we never move from just the smile. Perhaps instead, for me, the next stage of authentic dialogue should be a time of listening without as much as possible interpretation. And maybe that's the rub. It may not be possible, but at least that's the goal. Or at least, the very least, listening with the realization that what we hear and understand has been interpreted through our internal cognitive systems. We need to open ourselves to hear what the other person is telling us without trying to compare or contrast it or fit it into preconceived models. When we do this, we objectify the other. Through this process, the relationship built by the silent Buberian dialogue is enhanced as we come to appreciate not only the unity, but also the diversity of all that exists. Buber only leads us to unity. We need to see also the diversity and the uniqueness of each human individual. In fact, in one rabbinic midrash, This idea of absolute diversity is stressed even within the idea of the image of God. There's a question asked in the Talmud about all human beings are created in the same image. So then the Talmud contrasts a human king with God. A human king creates coins, all coins bearing his image, all identical. Well, at least in an ideal terms. When God according to the same Midrash, created human beings, minted us all in God's image. Each of us are totally unique. So there, it's yes, there is that same, the commonality, but it's also the uniqueness that's absolutely important as well, and something we should be looking for, and something should be the goal of dialogue. Once dialogue moves beyond silence to content, objectifying the other can also take the form of judgment and attempts to discern truth. As we listen to the other, it is not difficult to explicitly or implicitly judge a truth based on our own. And actually, one of the challenges I see to dialogue, and maybe I'm going to have to add a paragraph here about it, is it never really exists. How many people here have taken part in big interfaith dialogue / discussions? So, now, what are you doing when Rabbi Kunin is speaking? You're taking notes and scoring points. Ah, I should mention this. You're not really listening. More, you know, I don't know, I probably do this too. We're not really listening. We're thinking about, wow, what am I going to say? How can I sound as impressive or nice and warm and embracing as that guy did? The Santa Claus complex. So I think that maybe the first step that we should make whenever we organize any of these events is say no paper on the podium. You can't take notes. You just got to listen. And, you know, that's, you know, if you want to prepare your marks, you can do it beforehand. Now is your time to hear what the other people have to say. That's the whole point of your being here, after all. At least, that's what we hope. Or we take criteria, generally areas where our tradition excels, and examine the other based on these. Or we take criteria which are normative in our secular worldview, be they gender roles, and use these to judge other traditions or judge our own traditions. This process is an internal mirror of the search for essential messages and is built on the hierarchy of traditions where, of course, our Western wonderful secular tradition is the highest. And we judge everybody based on it. And of course, when we come to these dialogues, everybody wants to be part of this, so we all try to make our tradition fit as nicely as possible with the Western tradition, because that's part of the hugging process. This process is through this process of comparison, judgment, and attempted discernment of truth, we not only objectify the other, but we lose them in ourselves, because we begin to, that religion doesn't really like women. That's already a judgment that's failing to understand or listen to what that tradition really is saying. And we often fall into that trap when we're listening and being part of these dialogues. And let me give you an example of this. The complexity of this process is demonstrated in the influential work on interfaith dialogue by Raymond Panikkar, who is, I believe, a Jesuit from the East. Panikkar wrote a book called Intrafaith Dialogue, because I think he's mostly interested in internal dialogue, but his book generally faces all faiths. Panikkar notes the challenge and limitations of Buberian contentless dialogue as being insufficient as a means of creating understanding and appreciation. Like Buber, he suggests that the first essential meaning is between the I and the you, an experience of the connection between humans or between humanity and God. Unlike Buber, however, he suggests that, like I do, that this meeting is only the beginning of authentic dialogue, which, and this is where we differ, he believes is a substantially transformative process. For him, it's really a competition. He suggests and contends that based on the golden rule, dialogue is about true love and acceptance, and indeed the embrace of the other's beliefs. For Panikkar, and he states this explicitly, true dialogue is not only challenges a person, but it must also change him or her. One who engages in dialogue, he suggests, must be ready to convert if impelled by the experience. And that already gives us an idea of why he goes to the dialogue. I don't think anybody goes to a dialogue intending to become Catholic if they're not. But if I go to a dialogue and thinking about conversion, well, I wasn't, you know,
I've done that a few times.
Come as a Catholic? I hope more than a few times. No, yeah, I hope to, but you know, I don't think anybody goes to a dialogue hoping to leave as a different religion. Instead, if the idea of dialogue is about transformation and conversion, then you always go thinking, you know, I want you to become Jewish. You know, wouldn't it be great? Shelley's going to call her brother-in-law. We're going to arrange a circumcision room down the hall, and And Francis, Andrew, and I are going to be the Beit Din. And when we leave, there'll be 20 new Jews.
Dump,
we have to dump in the river too, that's right. Or dunk rather, not dump. But so I think that...
Sounds like the mafia.
It does. Okay. Want to engage is... Actually, it's interesting. Panikkar is not the first to suggest this, although Panikkar suggests it seriously. Herman Melville in Moby Dick suggests it in a very different way, also using the Golden Rule. The Golden Rule, love the other as yourself, leading to maybe either they convert to you or you convert to them. So in Moby Dick, Melville says the following. I don't have the quote here, but he says, Ishmael is invited by Queequeg to go to a pagan ceremony, and Ishmael thinks in his mind that just as he would like Queequeg to become a Presbyterian, so if he goes to the pagan ceremony and he likes it, according to the Golden Rule, he should become a pagan. So that's Panikkar's logic. Despite this apparent openness, in quotes, to the other, and the expressed willingness to hear and be transformed or even converted by different voices, he imposes a structure, a series of lenses, which actually render this impossible, based on his own tradition and his understanding of the you. So he suggests the following. These are the criteria for how he judges other religions. Christ is the Lord, but the Lord is neither only Jesus, nor does my understanding exhaust the meaning of the word. Sounds good, but there still is that problem that Christ is, you know, the Lord. That's still there, and that means that's a judgment call. Or, more tellingly, Christ is the only mediator. He is present and effective in any authentic religion. Christ is the symbol, which Christians call by this name, of the ever-transcending but equally ever-humanly imminent mystery. That's quite a nice phrase. I like that. I don't agree with it, but I like it. These modes of interpretation form an observed religion into a Christian interpretive model of the meaning of faith, and they only really work for Christianity, even if the other religion's worldview and understanding is totally different. It's interesting, there was, at the World Parliament of Religions back in 1893, one of the Unitarian presentation actually takes on the very much the same idea, saying that the one thing that unites true religions is incarnation. And there he's a bit more open because he's a Unitarian, so he says Buddha's a good example, Moses and Jesus are all examples of incarnation. But still, it's taking a Christian model and imposing it on everybody else. So it really isn't understanding them. It's only seeing them through our own lenses and seeing them as in us rather than as themselves. It may be difficult or even impossible to remove such lenses and not interpret the thou within the system of the I. Yet, dialogue in which we actually experience the thou in his or own authenticity requires at least the attempt. And elsewhere I've talked about looking at the idea of truth in a far more complex way than trying to identify the single unified truth, and I'm not going to do that here today, but I think trying to find models that allow us to be open to a multiplicity of truths, all of which are true and correct, is something that's essential in dialogue. And that's a radical transformation, so I'm being inconsistent, but so what? Foolish consistency is the hobgoblin of small minds. I have to admit that that's the radical system that I'm imposing on religion and how I look at religion. So that's my lens. When we hear or see someone or meet someone, we immediately begin the process of judgment with the traditional model of dialectic. And indeed, in Panikkar's non-dialectical, at least he claims it's a non-dialectical approach, we are also in the process of seeking truth and deciding you, me, new, or you, me. Whatever he wants, or you, me, you, whichever. There is certainly the synthesis, or at least the truth that's established through the process of the dialectic. Within an encounter of, we still are aiming at trying to find this unified truth, and generally we end up trying to find the other in ourselves. Therefore, within the encounter of dialogue, we also often tend to judge each new piece of information with the context of a single truth. I've said this already. If something challenges, is an antithesis of a previously held notion, is the challenge true, demanding transformation, or is it false, demanded to be rejected? Either way, in this model, a single synthesis is being sought. In my model, which is of dialectic, instead of looking to find the truth and therefore dialogue being weighing Netta's truth against my truth, instead hearing Netta's truth and accepting that that's her truth, hearing my truth and accepting that's my truth, that would be my dialectic. We move away from both objectifying and judging that which we hear or learn. Our ego should not be challenged or indeed gratified by what we find. So if I hear that Netta believes the same thing I do, that shouldn't, you know, that's great, but it shouldn't please me or gratify me because then I'm beginning to put her into my subject. Instead, we should listen with an interest built on a desire to hear and learn about the other human within his or her own terms. The knowledge enriches us even if it doesn't change us. We are therefore not troubled if their views or values challenge our own, since we are not seeking a single synthesis, the universal, but rather another of the many truths. And I think that's one area where that's where I'm going to stop. But I want to note that we often find one of the things that the big challenge that the Interfaith Center has, and that whenever anybody engages in any kind of dialogue, finds is that the fundamentalist views, voices are almost never present. And I think the reason why they're never present is because they rightly fear that the goal is to, the goal is often judgmental, but also the goal is about finding these universals and not really, and asking you to accept me and say, yes, of course, I believe, you know. Instead, if we allow for dialogue to be open, where we're just here to learn about you, not without judgment, but to learn, then that allows them to be present, because then they're presenting their view, and I don't have to accept it, I don't have to be changed by it, but I will know who you are as well as you'll know who I am. And that's all the goal is. So it really takes a radical rethinking of what dialogue is about, and if we choose difficult subjects, then even so, it still is possible. You know, the one on homosexuality had at least one somebody from the fundamentalist perspective, but he didn't feel, I don't think, the openness to present really what his church believes, or I don't know what he believes. Maybe he was being honest. I don't want to judge him, but I don't think he felt the freedom to do so, because within that context, he wanted to be warm and affirming. And I think dialogue should be, you know, it's maybe moving a dialogue away from, instead of being centered in a place where the whole audience wants to hear something and therefore you feel compelled to do it, instead try to create a place where you're discussing an issue without an agenda is something maybe more that would be very important for thinking about how to create a dialogue. So we're there to learn, not to judge, even if that which the other person says horrifies us, and we disagree with it fundamentally. You know, and at the Interfaith Center, we fell into this trap a few years ago in our sessions on women, that I think all the presentations of the major speakers that we chose were people who presented a more modernist understanding of the gender roles in religion. We didn't really search out and say, we want to hear voices from people who present a more traditional view of women's roles, and that we value those views as much as we value our more modernist understandings of the role of women in religion. So I think that's something to think about. Okay, I think with that, I've spoken for a little bit less than an hour, so why don't I open up for questions? Richard.
Well, thanks, David. That talk was characteristically so articulate, winsome, humorous, elucidating. I can go on and on. Thank you. I resonated with so much.
I appreciate the doxology, by the way.
Yeah. Praise be. And this means I wasn't listening. No, I was arguing with you already.
No, that's
but
fine.
You're Jewish, you must understand.
No, in this kind of...
That's a compliment.
In this kind of context, I want you to challenge what I have to say.
All right. Well, I did. I resonated so much with what you said about the complexity and the particularity of different religions. There's a book recently, what's it called? God is Not One, you know? And it's sort of this idea that, no, let's not impose, you know, I mean, let's actually listen. To what is different, and that's really difficult. And there are conversions involved in that. They may not be holus bolus conversions. This is what I was going to say. conversions happen all the time, right? But they're not necessarily, you know, eschewing or getting rid of whatever it is that you believed before. But there are conversions.
Oh, no. Anyway. Can I comment on that? And then
yeah.
So I think you're absolutely right. I think... I want to comment on two aspects of what you said. One is, I think you're right, that there, you know, dialogue can lead to transformation. You know, that's, and if it does, because I, you know, because I am transformed by what you say, you know, then that happens, and that's just where human beings and the stimuli that come in shape us, and our identities are constantly transforming. But what I'm saying is that I don't believe that dialogue, that should be the goal of dialogue, to transform the other. Then it becomes an exercise in colonialism, which for me is dangerous. The other thing I wanted to just mention, and then I'll let you finish your question, is I think you're absolutely right about this. God is not one. I read recently, there was a book called Radical Judaism, which was essentially a mystical theology of Judaism, and I was horrified. I'm horrified by almost everything I read. Because there, essentially he had this Darwinist idea about religion, which was amazingly, actually I call it a Spencerian view of religion because that's more accurate, of evolution, that was dominant at the Parliament of World Religions, but in there too, that there was this growth of religion naturally in its evolutionary form from polytheism to this, finally ending up with the top of the tree with monotheism, and that, you know, that was the top of the tree, and you know, religion is far more complicated than that. And if we take this nice human growth hormone, then we're going to be in trouble. Richard, finish up. Let me, Richard, finish up. Then Francis.
Yeah. Well, what I was getting to was just that early on in the talk, you had mentioned a speaker whose name you thought you might bastardize or whatever, but. He had suggested that we shouldn't be threatened by the otherness, you know, of the other.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I want to keep the threat, because the threat is what makes it exciting. My wife scares the hell out of me, and I'm still married to her after however many years. You know what I mean? And that's what keeps it interesting. And by this, what I mean is, like, you've threatened me on different occasions. Not you know, you've never physically threatened me.
No, I know what you mean.
But you know what I mean? By your ideas. And, you know, and in some ways, I might come away kind of wounded by it. That's that's hard. That's really hard. And you know, take a story from your tradition there, Jacob and the angel.
I think it's your tradition too, isn't it?
Pardon?
It's your tradition too.
Well, yeah.
Our tradition.
We appropriated. But anyway, he comes away wounded, right? Now, here's a question, okay? The question is, why would I go to something where I'm going to get wounded? Like, why would I run to the moth to the flame? Why would I, or the lemming to the sea? Or why would I, you know, why would I do that? And of course, Lutherans have an answer. I won't tell you what it is. Because it's so profound. It's what I call that answer. Other ideas. Anyway, but it's called an external word, right? Okay, so, like, but that is a question. Why would we do that? Why would we engage in something that's threatening, that's going to leave us wounded?
And actually, Richard, I think we, as usual, we totally agree. I think that's the goal of dialogue, is to be willing to be wounded and to hear those things that we don't want to hear. That I think that's the challenge that the dialogue is the biggest challenge of what dialogue exists today, is that people are so afraid of saying something that's going to challenge anybody else and present our religion in ways that you might find is horrifying, that we don't say it because we're afraid to say something that's difficult. And I think real dialogue is about saying things that are difficult and saying things that are going to challenge other people about what they're expected, the accepted norms, but also how they look, you know, how they expect us to be. And I think you're absolutely right. And that's what I think those people at that dialogue about parenting failed to understand, is they got upset because someone was presenting Christianity in a way that didn't embrace their, you know, fit their nice embrace, and they were upset by it. But I think that dialogue was a success, not a failure, because someone was brave enough to challenge. Francis, yeah, and then...
Okay. I'm not quite sure what I want to say, but that's the nature of dialogue. I was wondering through your talk about the positives. You know, you talked a lot about all the habits of dialogue which impede dialogue. I'm wondering about whether you've got any dialogists whom you find to be models. I was thinking, I gave a response to a book on comparative philosophy in Victoria, and comparative philosophy and comparative religion. And one of the contributors was Francis Clooney, who I think the David was there, who talked about the importance of close reading. You know, of reading texts, both in one's own tradition and other people's tradition, with immense attention over many years. And he spent a lot of time comparing a Hindu text and a Catholic text. He was Catholic. And he talked about praying the Hindu text. And I think that's a kind of model where one can actually know what that tradition is, adopt the kinds of rituals and forms of the tradition, be in one's own place, but be able to live through.
With all possible respect to my teacher, I totally disagree with you. I don't think you can. I think that if you study the text with a Hindu who then shares their close reading of the text, then I think you have a chance of understanding the text in an authentic way. But I don't think it's possible for, you know, if I spend all my time reading a Christian text, I'm still going to impose myself and my Jewish values on that text.
He did that study with him.
Well, but I think that I don't. And I think that, you know, I think as long as if you're close reading with other people, but I don't know that praying the text, you know, I think that becomes inauthentic. I think it becomes inauthentic to you, and it becomes inauthentic to the other. In another place, I look at this in thinking about the nature of interfaith services. I think interfaith services are one of the most difficult things that exist. And I think, I don't mean by this having a service where we try to make a mold, but say a service where many people, leaders from very different faiths, are offering prayers. That's what I'm defining. When I first started out many, many years ago at these kind of services, usually it was on Thanksgiving, so the end of November.
When Thanksgiving is, apparently,
yes. And what we would do is, you know, and this was really actually in the fairly early days of interfaith. So there was mostly Jewish Christian encounters, and sometimes you'd include the Protestants. But very rarely would there be Muslims involved. Islam was not hugely widespread, you know, at least visibly in the United States at the time, especially in small communities. You know, so in maybe in the big cities it already included Islam, but outside of the cities it didn't. And I remember, but even with where, say, you have Islam, what would be, the interfaith service would be the following. The Christian would say, you know, maybe he'd read part of the Lord's Prayer, but he'd cut out "in Christ's name" at the end, because, of course, we don't want to offend the Jews by mentioning Christ. And the Jews would do their prayers nice, you know, "grant us peace, your most precious gift, O thou eternal source of peace," and do it nicely in English. And that would be the interfaith service. Everybody would feel good. Wow, we all share the same idea. You know, it goes back to the hug mentality that I talked about. And I think that they were a total waste of time. Because I don't know anything about Catholicism. And for probably most of the Catholic priests who did that, they probably felt, well, this prayer didn't go anywhere, because if you don't have the formula at the end, it doesn't actually get to God. So, at least in my understanding of...
And the Jewish prayer not said in Hebrew, well, obviously doesn't get to...
Well, no, that's not true, because we believe that God... No. But it certainly wasn't done in an authentic way to me. And then, of course, we had the wonderful moment of sameness, where the because at the synagogue where I was a student, they happened to be, I think, Franciscan friars were running the church, and they wear kippahs and we wear kippahs. Oh, isn't it wonderful? We all wear kippahs. You know, let's embrace. Isn't it great? We're all the same. Now, so that's, and I think that's the problem. Today, I think there's a more authentic, often, not all everywhere, but in Edmonton at least, when the Interfaith Center does interfaith type events of this nature, instead of everybody doing things to make, and, well, at least this is the model, and we don't quite get to it yet, but this is where I would want it to be. So that when the Jew does a prayer, he does it in Hebrew. When the Hindu does the prayer, he or she does it in Hindi and doesn't fudge over the fact that she's praying to a god. And when the Catholic does it, he does it with, or she does it with, in Christ's name, amen. You know, it's not going to offend anybody. It doesn't offend me to hear about that. Instead, I learn about an authentic prayer from that tradition, and it enriches me. That's fine. I think I don't want to pray in other people's tongues. I want to be part. I want to share and value what they're doing while being authentic to myself. That's where I am. But I understand with, okay. Yes. And then Larry, and then in the back.
So I'm confused, and Kathy. But I'm easily confused. And here are a few of the things you talked about that confused. First of all, dialogue to me means dia, two people, two entities. And as soon as there are more than two totally individual entities involved in the dialogue, to me, it's not truly a dialogue. So that's one confusion. The other is calling an interfaith center an interfaith center, because the implication is that all the people who are participating have some kind of faith. And calling it interreligious is implying that they all have a religion. And I don't know what your definition of religion or faith would be. And
okay.
So
your first question is absolutely right, that obviously using dialogue in any of these encounters is to some degree a misnomer. But it's a term we have, you know, and when you start using trilogue, multilogue, decalogue, I don't know, it gets a bit confusing.
Conversation.
So, you know, you're right. And maybe, you know, for Buber, he would say that one individual to another, in that much more limited sense, is really the place of authentic meeting. And I wouldn't disagree with that, but you have to deal with the tools you have. That's why I think that the conversations, if push would come to shove, I would say that the real dialogue happens between the two people at the table, and the other thing is just a waste of time. Because then I'm learning about David, and David's learning about me, and that's, you know, instead of the talking heads. But ultimately, this is what we have, so we've got to deal with it. And so I think then the second question is more interesting. The problem with any term is it's a grand narrative by which we try to unify whole series of disparate types of phenomena. And when we try to be narrow in our construction of what exactly it means, we end up getting in trouble. So that I've seen definitions of religion, people unite, you know, with systems of belief in a God. Well, Judaism isn't hugely built on a system of belief. It's something very different. At least for some, Buddhism isn't about a deity, albeit for others, Buddhism is. Once you create the definition, then you start excluding. For me, therefore, I don't want a definition. I say, you know, the Interfaith Center was called the Interfaith Center long before my time, and it's a place of people to meet to discuss all the variety of things that we call religion. Now, and the Interfaith Center has been really good about that, in that no one is excluded. So that there are times where people will say, they're Scientologists, that's, you know, that's a religion for profit, it's not a real, well, maybe it was, but it also is a religion that meets the needs of people who choose to be part of it. And I get horrified when Germany starts making laws against Scientology, because I think ultimately, you know, once you start making, you know, there was that famous thing, you know, first they came for the communists, but I wasn't a communist, and they came for the Jews, then came for the homosexuals and the Catholics, and since I wasn't any of these, I didn't worry, and when they came for me, there was nobody left to care. And so I think creating definitions is really dangerous. That's why, actually, I wrote an article that was published in the Journal of...
German Protestant, by the way.
That's correct, yes.
A Lutheran.
A Lutheran, by the way, yes. So one of the very, yeah. So the I wrote an article recently which I called, I like the multi-faith better than interfaith. And so I try to use, that's what I, so I called it multi-faith, a postmodern endeavor. Meaning, get away from all these definitions because definitions are dangerous. And the journal insisted that, they told me, oh, postmodernism is passé. Then I said, your modernism is so not passé. Yeah. So they insisted that my postmodernism was passé. They also, I talked about the imposition of the golden rule as a neo-colonialist thing, and they said, you got to get rid of that. We don't want to be called colonialists. I got in trouble sometimes for calling people colonialists. only with affection. Although not in that article, by the way. And they, no, with the article, it wasn't with affection. It was being deadly serious. And when I've done it in other contexts, it was perhaps only for effect, and I apologize for doing it. No, but seriously, I think that my, what I meant by a postmodern endeavor is a resistance to any definition of religion. That if someone sees themselves and what they, what their thing as a religion, then for me that's a religion, and it's not for me to judge. So that's where I come from.
Was there one more?
Okay, no, let me.
On the docket.
I want
to. We have to. We have to wind, yes. Wind up this part of it up.
So I want. In thank you, David, for reminding me that we come to an end. I could probably go on talking for hours.
The bar is open.
The bar is open. So but I do want to thank. I want to thank a variety of. There are a number of groups that have been important to my stay in Edmonton. And I want to thank all of them because they're all present. Actually, nearly all my volunteer work is present here in this room today. I was briefly on the board of Jewish Family Services. I've been on the board of the Multicultural Foundation, which is represented by Ava. But even more importantly, for really my formative work in Edmonton, being part of the interfaith chaplaincy at the university, and I think Richard probably was president when I first started up. So I want to thank Richard and Denise, Audrey, and all my colleagues at the chaplaincy at the university. I want to thank Earl for choosing me to be the first Jew on the academic side. I don't know who chose me, but chose me to be the first Jew on the academic senate of St. Stephen's. That was quite an eye-opening and important experience in my life. And also David for allowing me to be on the advisory board of the Chester Ronning Center, which is also something that was very important. It gave me an opportunity to share quite a number of my ideas in public. And I want to thank Francis and Andrew from the University from Religious Studies for likewise being a venue for that as well. And so, and oh, I shouldn't forget Netta and the other people from the Interfaith Center from the day I came to Edmonton till now, really an important part of my growth and a sounding board, not always happily, of my ideas about interfaith. Not Netta, but other people. But so I appreciate and thank all of these people and all of these groups.
Well, I think I can speak for all of us that it's been lovely that you have been here with us and that we've had a chance to work with you and get to know you. You became a lot happier after this woman entered your room. I recall. When you mentioned smiling, I thought to myself, I don't think I ever saw Rabbi Davis smile until Shelley came into his life. But that may have been just where I met you. Too much time at the synagogue or something.
Not a smiling man.
That's right.
Hardly a joking man.
But it's been a pleasure and a delight, and we're filled with gratitude, and I wish I could say with a little more, well, I can say it like this. We are happy that we have come to this day, but for my part, I wish you weren't gone. So, farewell, and it's lovely that the community in Japan will have you for a while. So thank you so much.